Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
I took a walk down to the ice.
Did you get out for a walk or a hike during the pandemic in 20 below this winter? Emily Ford did.
So now we're hiking to the other end. See Diggins here, pulling away. Oh, she stopped.
We'll hear the incredible story with her borrowed dog, Diggins, hiking 1,100 miles across Wisconsin.
You were walking on ice.
Then, they're a group of 30 diverse individuals from around the state, determined to bring Wisconsin closer to achieving equity and inclusion. Those stories and the regional news and review after this.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
I took a walk down to the ice.
Did you get out for a walk or a hike during the pandemic in 20 below this winter? Emily Ford did.
So now we're hiking to the other end. See Diggins here, pulling away. Oh, she stopped.
We'll hear the incredible story with her borrowed dog, Diggins, hiking 1,100 miles across Wisconsin.
You were walking on ice.
Then, they're a group of 30 diverse individuals from around the state, determined to bring Wisconsin closer to achieving equity and inclusion. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. So with all of us locked down and locked in for most of the past year, have you taken time to get outside on the trails or the rest of the great outdoors where you could stay away from other humans and not be cooped up? I hope so, but I'm betting even if you have, it was weather permitting, and most of us didn't take an 1,100-mile hike in occasionally sub-zero temperatures. Well, our guest is someone who did, completing Wisconsin's Ice Age Trail, and I think it was called that before she found out how cold it was, in just under 10 weeks, accompanied by a borrowed sled dog named Diggins. Emily Ford is safe and sound, and maybe still a little bit sore, and she joins me now from her Duluth home. Welcome to Simply Superior.
Thank you for having me.
So I know it wasn't a race, but your official time was, 69 days? Did you count minutes, hours, seconds?
I did not count down to that minutia. I should have, though.
And, I'll just go into one simple question, which I think might be like asking a mountaineer about the mountain. Why?
Well, you know what? It's so funny that the why question is such a common question. You know, why do we do anything that we love? I just wanted to get out and go on a trail that was, you know, 1,000 miles long. I've wanted to do a long through hike for a while. And I was out playing volleyball with a buddy. And she's like, well, what about the Ice Age Trail? And I was like, don't know what that is, but that sounds great. That's kind of how this all got kicked off, actually.
Well, but this wasn't your first, right? So I know that much. You've done the Superior Trail, or I think there may be more than one.
I have. I've done the Superior Hiking Trail. It's a beautiful trail. If you've never been on it, you should. And I've done some other shorter ones, but they are equally as relentless. The Border Route Trail, which borders the U.S. and Canada, kind of dipping into the Boundary Waters Wilderness. And the Kekakabik Trail, which is 42 miles, but literally in the middle of nowhere and beautiful.
Well, you found a lot of nowhere on this one, but the other part of this, as I alluded to, it was called the Ice Age Trail before you found out how cold it was. You did this in a winter. I'm told you are the second person to complete the trail in the winter. So I'm wondering, by the way, did you do the Superior Hiking Trail in the summer or winter? Or?
Yeah, so I work for Glensheen. I'm their head gardener. It's a historic mansion in town. And I get laid off for 3 months in the wintertime, just super rad. I love having 3 months off. And so this was really the only time I had to do that many miles all in one go. So that's the why for the winter. I did the Superior in a shoulder season. So I believe I did that in the fall. I did the Keck maybe in the summer. And I did the Border Route at the same time that I did the Superior Hiking Trail.
Mm-hmm.
So everything else I've done has either been in the fall or in the summer. Ish time. So yeah, it just so happened. And you know what? Here's the thing though. Like Man, winter gets such a bad rap. Like, I wish it didn't, because it's the completion, right? It's the completion of our four seasons. You know what I mean? Like, don't forget how, when in the middle of winter, don't forget how much you complain about the humid summer, right? So we get the balance. We get those two very cold weeks every winter. We call it the polar vortex. And then we get those 2 weeks in the summer that are hotter than Hades, right? But there's beauty in both of them as well. So
right.
I'm hoping that more people, you know, get their time outside after me being home.
I'm not sure it completely balances out where we are. I mean, Duluth is called the air-conditioned city. And so, yeah, you say 2 weeks in the summer, maybe more like a week. And, you know, 90 degrees isn't quite the same as 30 below. So, but I do want to talk about that in terms of the hike, the trip. You went from, I think you had the highs of 40 above to 37 below, right? So how in the world do you, at first, survive that? And then second, how do you pack for that?
Right. Yeah, so on those really cold nights, really awesome people allowed us to stay in their house. So the sleeping bag that I brought with me was rated for 30 below. But the wind chill was so cold. It was like 40 something below. I know it sounds, I thought that was going to be good enough for this trip, but I was wrong. I really underestimated the Midwest. I should not have done that. So some really cool people let me and dig in. So we stayed in people's houses, usually in their basements. Well, but we would definitely hike through, you know, during the day. That's how we did that. And how do you pack for it? I mean, it's all about layers, you know, it's all about layers. It's not so much of how you stay warm. It's making sure that you don't sweat too much. Because when you're moving, right, when you're hiking, post-holing through deep snow or trudging through deep snow all day long, it's actually, no matter how cold it is, it's actually pretty easy to sweat. So even on, a 0-degree day, I would have a couple base layers on top and then just a raincoat and then mittens, a hat, and blah, blah, blah. But it's not like I would be bundled in a goose down jacket or anything like that. So, yeah.
All right. We are speaking with Emily Ford of Duluth, who last week completed her 10-week hike of Wisconsin's Ice Age Trail, stretching 1,100 miles from the Sturgeon Bay area near Green Bay to Polk County or St. Croix Falls via Janesville, which is not the fastest way to get there. And you are referring to yourselves plural. The plural part would be the dog Diggins, who was not your dog. Diggins was a barrel sled dog. How was she recruited, and what was her job?
Yeah, so I found her just by posting to a Facebook group and asking people if I could borrow their dog, and I got one reply, and it was from Diggins' owner. And her job was, I don't know, originally it was just to be there. She's a puller, so she pulled along. She's ahead of me. She was tied to me via Skidorian belt. She was there kind of mostly for companionship. And she did a great job at both pulling and being a companion.
I had reached out to you by Facebook message. Of course, you were communicating with the entire world, and I saw that it was growing and growing. Your Instagram followers got to be quite plentiful. And I had asked if you were interested in talking to us, if, you know, we could do this piece we're doing now. But I was thinking, I try to be mindful of these things, that I don't really want to tell the whole world where Emily is at any particular time. We used to have a thing in my many years working in newspapers, not to say someone would be on vacation, because you were basically saying when to rob their house. Now, in the age of social media, everybody says, oh, I'm on vacation, and nobody seems to care anymore. All right. So, but all that being said, how mindful were you of safety? And did Diggins have a part in that? Or, you know, what precautions did you take? Or am I just a worrywart?
You're not the first person to ask me that. I'm pretty liberal with my safety, I'm realizing. after this trip, so a lot of people had the question of, like, do I bring protection, blah, blah, blah. So I'm like, no, I have like a pocket knife and a dog, you know, that's pretty much it. But people were, a couple of things. You know, people were pretty mindful about not stating exactly where I was at the time. They had a pretty good idea. It's kind of hard to keep a secret of what county I was in. You know, so if you needed to find me, you could at least figure out what county I'm in. or was in, and all stuff like that. I didn't really run into any issues with people or animals. People were very kind to me on the trail. And I think if, you know, anybody that would have wanted, I don't know, had any issue with the trip, I don't think they even paid attention to the story. So, yeah, that's that.
Hmm. Well, you're getting also a bit of notice for helping to break stereotypes about African-Americans not being outdoors people. One of my closest friends in town is Dudley Edmondson, who has worked a lifetime on that front. And that stereotype is based on good reasons. Black people were not long welcome in national parks and other places like that. And just at the time of George Floyd's death, if we remember, I think the same week, there was a black bird watcher, Mr. Cooper, in Central Park, who had a deal with a white woman calling the police on him as she was breaking a law with her dog. So what's been the response, reaction?
Yeah, it was great. I think people are so excited to, you know, especially for people of color, right? We're just so excited to see other people doing something that we've always longed to do that isn't, recently, traditionally something that we do, right? So even if our ancestors were mainly outdoors, right? Gatherers, hunters, people farming, lots of farmers. Nowadays, it may not be as apparent to us that that's our history, actually. So there's been a great response, you know, parents with their little kids, really encouraging their little kids to get outside. Again, you know, people my age outside and other adults who are older than me outside, just, you know, I'm hoping that message kind of came across clear of, like, my whole main shtick is just, like, if you don't feel like you check the right boxes, quote unquote, to do the thing, like, you totally do, like, especially in the outdoors, like, you're totally welcomed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's coming across quite clear, and people responded really well to it.
What, in general, what did you think before you went on it would be the most challenging park, and what did it turn out to be?
You know what? I don't know if I even thought about things being challenging before I left. Like, probably the cold, right? Just being like, all right, it's going to be cold. But I don't really remember being worried about the cold too much.
Yeah, you had that 30 below rated sleeping bag, right?
Well, yeah, so I had a really warm sleeping bag, but then also if you remember, the beginning of winter was actually quite lovely.
Mm-hmm.
Not as lovely as the ending is. You know, it was warm, and so I wasn't really worried about that. The hardest part, my hardest days were kind of getting over my own self, right, in my pace. So those days I had to post hole forever, it felt like. I was going about at a half mile an hour. And, like, on a good day, I can hike 3 miles an hour. And it was just, like, this dragging of my mind slowly going through the snow. And I'm like, I'm never going to reach the end. And I would have never thought that post-holing was going to be my demise before I left.
What's the word you're using there again?
Oh, post-holing. Like, yeah, like when your foot goes through deep snow and it makes a post-hole. Uh-huh. And you have to just keep going through that. Because I left my snowshoes behind at a certain point on the trip because I didn't really need them.
Except that those moments, you kind of wish you had them.
I did, but it was really, really in my last 2 weeks. You know, out of almost 10 weeks. 2 weeks is, and it wasn't every day. It was like just moments in those 2 weeks. I don't regret the decision not bringing them through the whole thing because they're heavy and I would have had to carry them.
Right. Yep. That's always a consideration, how much you carry. What about how far you went in a day? Was it consistent, or did you have some days where you really blew through it, and other days those depressing moments that you just described?
Yeah. In the beginning, I would shoot for like 20-ish miles a day, between 15 and 20. Like I said, it was warm. The trails were pretty packed down, as in a pretty populated spot, or I had a lot of road walking to do, which is pretty easy. Then as I got towards the end, there's a terrible, terrible cliche saying, but I'll state it here anyway, it's smiles, not miles. And so just keeping yourself happy and not worried about all your mileage. And so actually towards the end, after I picked my end date officially, I chugged myself down to just reaching for 15 miles a day. And it was great.
Well, that's not too hokey of a cliche, and I can see how it really works, too. So, again, we're speaking with Emily Ford of Duluth, who last week completed her 10-week hike of Wisconsin's Ice Age Trail, which goes 1,100 miles, 1,136, I believe, from Sturgeon Bay to St. Croix Falls. What was the most unexpected or memorable thing that you saw along the way?
I know this is exciting for anybody else besides me or not, so I'll try to describe it in good enough detail. I did not know that grouse buried themselves in the snow, and you cannot tell where they are. Like, especially if you're not looking for them, you have no idea where they are. So one day, Biggins and I are walking along a trail, and out of the earth, out of the snowy earth, bursts three grouse, like popcorn, out of the snow, and they fly away. And if you've ever heard a grouse fly, they're pretty clumsy flyers, so they kind of clap their wings as they go along. I don't know if I was scared or whatever, but I just fell to my knees and started laughing so hard. It was the craziest thing I've ever seen in my entire life, and it was wonderful.
Ah, well, you weren't hunting them, but that does lead me to ask, what were you doing for food? And what was Diggins doing for food?
Mm-hmm. So a lot of trail magic happened. Trail magic is when people magically appear with things that you need or want. So through the day, I ate a lot of Clif bars, a lot of like Luna bars, Pro bars, stuff like that, a lot of bars. Lots of candy, lots of Snickers is what I ate, lots of nuts, lots of dried fruit. And that night, I would have freeze-dried food, so like a Mountain House or Alpine Air. We just add a little bit of water to it. And Diggins, she had her own kibble. Her kibble's by Redpaw. And that's what she had. She had that and any other roadkill she could find during the day or other carcasses.
So after 1,100 miles, are we still sore, or does it become a throbbing pain that you just get used to, or how's that been?
Yeah, as soon as I got back, I have a massage therapist in Duluth. I am so mindful of my muscles. My body is really important to me, and kind of I'm not a fitness guru, but I want to be a strong human being for as long as I can. So he's worked with me for a long time. So I booked two days worth of sessions with like 4.5 hours of work. So we're looking pretty good. My body feels great. I just went for a hike today and it was awesome.
Well, if anyone deserves a 2-day session, you do. So has this changed your life in any way?
I think so. I still love backpacking as much as I did before. So maybe not in that essence, but it's changed my life I never thought that I would be part of the onslaught of other folks of color who try to encourage people to, be outside and, be a face of color outdoors. Mm-hmm. So that's very new to me. And that's awesome. I don't generally do interviews every day.
Well, I was about to say, aside from the angle of color, if that's the way we put it, you are getting a lot of attention. I see The Guardian has done a story about you. Of course, all of our local media. And you hit the big time with our show. You know that. So
yes, I'm at the top.
But you are getting attention. Both, again, helping to spread the idea that people of color can and do go in the outdoors, and just in general for someone who, again, the second person to actually do this whole route. Would you do it again, or do you have other hikes in the immediate future plan?
Nothing in the immediate future that's like, once work starts up, for all you gardeners out there, you understand, like, once the season kind of hits, you're kind of tied to the gardens for that season. But I don't know what I'll do next winter. I'll probably go on a few week-long hikes at least this year and mm-hmm. get that taken care of. Who's to say, man? Who's to say?
All right. One more thing. Have you talked to Diggins since you got back?
Yeah, her mom sent me a video of her. I think I have some stuff to, I have some appointments to do in the cities, which is pretty close to where she lives. And I think I will go down and see her and play with her for a little bit, because I miss her. I miss her immensely. I know that I made a wise decision to not ask to keep her. My life does not support her lifestyle, which is that she needs to be out, and about and running around and pulling and everything else pertinent here every day. And I just can't support that with my lifestyle. But even though I know it was a wise decision, it still hurts my heart a little bit that she's not with me every day. But I do have a dog at home. He's pretty cool. I love him, so not all is lost.
All right. Well, when you do stop by and see Diggins, tell her to give us a call, because you know, you shouldn't take all the limelight here. And I'm sure we could have a very good interview, right?
She's really chatty, actually. It's amazing. You'd be surprised.
Great. We've been speaking with Emily Ford of Duluth, who last week completed her 10-week hike of Wisconsin's Ice Age Trail. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. This has been great.
Coming up, the Governor's Council on Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion gets to work. And in honor of Emily Ford's and Diggins' trailblazing trek, here's Devon Square with Walking on Ice.
I took a walk down to the ice. Don't you remember how we used to? Followed the moon down through the trees. Cause there's a place I used to see you. The sun turned the sky blue. You were walking on ice.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. With the trial of Derek Chauvin for the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis, the shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, and the rise of white supremacy seemingly everywhere, racial issues have been front of mind throughout the country, and Wisconsin is certainly no exception. The Governor's Advisory Council on Equity and Inclusion has been formed to address some of those issues and last month held its first meeting. Three members of that council, two hailing from northwestern Wisconsin, join us to talk about the group's mission and what they hope to accomplish. And with me to facilitate the discussion is my Wisconsin Public Radio colleague, Dean Kallenbach, from our Eau Claire Bureau. Welcome, Dean.
Robin, good to have you along today.
And let's introduce our three guests. Odawa White is Dean of Student Affairs at Lacouturay Ojibwe College in Hayward. Welcome, Odawa White.
Thank you. Really glad to be here with you today.
Also joining us today is Mai Zhang. She is president of Hmong American Leadership and Economic Development and was elected last year to the Eau Claire City Council. Mai, good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Robin and Dean.
The chair of the Governor's Advisory Council on Equity and Diversity is Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Safety and Professional Services, Dawn Krim. Secretary Krim, thanks for coming on the show.
Great. Thank you so much for having us.
So, Odawa White, you work with the Lacouturay Ojibwe College in Hayward. Tell us about your background and how you came to be appointed to the council.
Okay. Yep. I started out as a state employee. So I worked for University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire for 18 years. And then I grew up in Lacouturay Ojibwe Reservation. And it made sense that I made the transition to Dean of Student Affairs. And I became part of this because of some of the work that I've done, some of the trainings that I've done surrounding American Indian students and higher education in particular, and then some of my presentations and as far as understanding of my culture and my heritage and my history. So, and I'm always amazed about these opportunities to be able to provide any sort of understanding around issues related to diversity, inclusion, and equity, because my background at UW-Eau Claire was I worked in multicultural affairs pretty much for a really long time.
Mai Zhang, you run the organization called Hmong American Leadership and Economic Development. Talk about the focus of that organization and what you're hoping to add to the Governor's Council.
Yeah, thank you so much, Dean. I am excited to share that Hmong American Leadership and Economic Development, a not-for-profit, nonprofit grassroots organization that was founded by a group of young Hmong professional in 2019. Really, the organization was founded to strategically advocate for equitable economic and social opportunities for the Hmong community and other underserved groups in rural Western Wisconsin. We are based out of Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and we tend the goal for Hailed and what we've been doing since our founding is really to build purposeful and meaningful relationships with partners and collaborators to really establish culturally competent pathways to addressing economic and social disparities, and really creating intentional community development. There are so many issues that intersect with this intersectionality of issues that impacts a person's ability to grow wealth. And then it also impacts, we realize that here in Western Wisconsin, we can't start dividing groups by racial status. We're so limited with the number of minorities. So we do create, our goal is to really create this non-traditional platform to networking so we could really bridge the professionalism, the opportunities, and the networking to our communities, underserved communities. So we're hoping that that's something that we're able to bring to the council, really at this broad lens of being minority and in the rural, being in rural Wisconsin, where the disparities and the things that we face over here is dramatically different than if it is in an urban space.
Mm-hmm. Don Krim, what's the mission for the group and what are key issues that you hope to address?
Well, thank you again for having me. When you think about this council, the governor has been talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion since he was elected. And so for the past 2 years, he's been laying the groundwork for this next step, which would include those professionals all around the state who are already doing this work and having some success. A year ago, he passed Executive Order 59, which charged all state agencies to begin looking at their data, reviewing their policies, and through the lens of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And as a part of that charge, all state agencies have created diversity, equity, and inclusion plans to really examine and evaluate the work that's being done at the state agencies and participation so that all Wisconsinites can be a part of the state workforce. The state's workforce is the largest workforce across the state. And so he wants to ensure that state government works for all and is inclusive of all. And so this council is an extension of that Executive Order 59, in which we are tasked with providing insight, feedback, evaluation of the work that's currently taking place in state government, trying to develop a framework that promotes diversity, equity, and inclusion all across the state. And the reason why the council has been enacted with about 31 members is that we want to hear from those experts that are already doing this work in their communities. We believe working together, the nonprofits, for-profits, and state government all can lift the conversation around equity and inclusion, as well as look at best practices and structures that can be systemic.
All right. Well, let's drill down a little bit deeper. One definition of racism that's gaining currency is that it flows from a base of power to those with less power. Government has been a mechanism used in racism. We know that. Cities redlining certain neighborhoods, for example. So as chair of the Governor's Advisory Council on Equity and Inclusion, what do you see as vestiges of institutional racism that the governor and the state government needs to deal with?
Well, I think as you talked about racism, you know, we think about the systemic nature of it. So as the example you provided about redlining, Odawa could talk about how American Indians have been treated. Maya could certainly talk about the resettlements and just the welcoming or not welcoming of our partners from Laos and Cambodia and other countries where many of our Hmong people have joined the states. And so I think what has been in place is systematically keeping those without power, those immigrants, those who are new, or those who have been here but not recognized, out. And those systemic issues show themselves in policies, procedures, who has access to economics. And so what we're trying to do from a root cause standpoint is look at those statutes, those regulations, those policies that are in place that might be structured in a way that does not allow for equitable participation of all Wisconsinites. And so by asking members of the council to work with us, with state government, we believe we can have some systematic evaluation, analyzation, and best practices across the entire state.
We're talking with the three members of the new Equity and Inclusion Advisory Council appointed by Governor Evers. They are the chair of that group, Dawn Krim, who you just heard. She is the secretary designee of the Wisconsin Department of Safety and Professional Services. Also with us today, Mai Zhang. She is president of the Hmong American Leadership and Economic Development Organization and a member of the Eau Claire City Council. And Odawa White. He is the dean of student affairs at the Lacoutere Ojibwa College in Hayward. Robin Washington from Simply Superior is joining me to ask the questions. I'm Dean Colin Back. Next question goes to Mai Zhang. The council is charged with reviewing and analyzing rules and policies relating to home ownership and business development, and economic development is a particular focus of yours. Where do you see obstacles that state government might be able to clear?
Yeah, so we've been having this conversation over the last few years of where some of those disparity lies, and some of those unintentional, maybe intentional, barriers. So when we talk about state contracting, and for example, let's one of the biggest issue that we do have in like marginalized communities, or even just specifically drilling down to the Hmong community, is that we're a very monolingual community. A lot of our parents, the Hmong language only existed since the 1950 for the written language. So it's been a very much spoken language. Those who do know how to read and write in Hmong are more privileged a lot, and it's far fewer than those that just speak the language. And so when we're talking about getting access to lingual through the state, getting our parents being able to come in and have those conversations, and those, how we get interpreters, because I think we have translators who has to go through this vigorous certification process. I think these are the type of things where is the state making it more accessible for folks to then have proper interpretation and provide more lingual access to communities that do need it. And so these are the things that we are looking at. In addition to, that's going to help with our contractors. We have a lot of young folks that are going to be able to do that. And that's also looking at that capability of being your own entrepreneur, setting your own time, being able to then also have the experience with contracting with the state. Contracting is also another problem that we are looking at. And it's not just a state problem, but it's a problem that even at the local level, I'm having conversations with our city, is our procurement process. Are we being equitable and intentional about who we bring on and who we are able to elevate and help get those contracts to minorities? Are we looking at minorities, or are we just lumping women business owned as minorities? And these are the things that we want to make sure that it's intentional, and we are creating opportunities for other folks, emerging entrepreneurs, emerging minority businesses, to be able to get that same opportunity to jump on. And that's a part of the state process, that these are the little things that we can make big impacts in small communities by giving these, opening up these opportunities for folks to be able to join us. And a matter of fact is, how do we help them build wealth and equity, right, as a state?
So while we're talking about building wealth and equity in business economics and then home ownership, of course, education is another component of all this. Dr. White, that's your area of expertise. Where can state government improve access to education for BIPOC or minority populations?
Okay, well, first of all, I usually start this out before I speak, and that's just the acknowledgement of the lands that we all reside on right now. And historically, our Indigenous people that represent Wisconsin, our five Wisconsin bands, and then Dakota people and other federally recognized tribes, Ho-Chunk, Bode, Wadami, Menominee, Oneida, Stockbridge, Muncie. And so I just like to give that recognition that we reside on these lands that were historically represented by these tribes, and we still are present in the in Wisconsin. And so from an educational standpoint, I know that the governor had issued some money to be able to look at race-based mascots in education. And so that's been always a priority within Wisconsin Indian Education, National Indian Education Association. And so all these associations that denounce the use of mascots and race-based names in schools and school districts across the state. And part of that, it has to do with the self-esteem and the self-image of Native students and in education. And so that goes along the lines with that whole idea of gaining access and making sure that we're equitable across all lines. And so when we look at like the UW system, we want to make sure that that there's representation from all areas of students of color, minorities, indigenous people. And we're looking at hiring practices, looking at best practices, excellence, and diversity and equity inclusion across the state. And so these are all important information. When we look at Act 31 across the state, that's another area too in education where school districts are required to teach history and in all grade levels, fourth through 12th grade. And so curriculum has to focus on teaching those grade levels, as well as when you're looking at licensing, pre-licensed teachers also have to gain that information about minority groups, relations, instruction and history, culture, tribal sovereignty, and most of all the information regarding federally recognized American Indian tribes and bands in the state. So I want to make sure that we keep these conversations at the forefront and know that there's also this inequity in education that we need to move forward with.
Now, the summer's protests spurred by the death of George Floyd and the shooting of Jacob Blake were much about the way the branch of government that is law enforcement deals with Black members of the community. Don Krim, how much of a focus will policing be on the conversations of the council?
So I appreciate you mentioning George Floyd's name, because as you know, there was definitely an awareness and awakening of how Black men have been treated over the years, over the decades. And so what we know is that an evaluation certainly needs to take place around training and about the way sometimes the arrests are administered. And so this governor is supportive of education and banning those practices that may not be necessary for usage. And so when you think about this council won't be directly addressing those issues per se, but we'll be talking about policy procedures that are best practices that could be used by law enforcement or endorsed and supported by state governments all around the state. And so top to bottom, really looking for input from our leaders that are on the council and thinking about, again, what policies we might impact.
Hi, Zhang. Contrasting with, we heard Adawa White talk about the need to teach the history of Native Americans in Wisconsin and the centuries that we're talking about there. And contrasting with that, Hmong Americans are among the newest ethnic group in our country, with most of the immigration happening in the past 50 years. What particular challenges does that present as you speak for the Hmong community on the Governor's Council?
Yeah, thank you so much for that question. In fact, we've been just having this conversation, and in respect of to what both my colleague has just said, it is a cultural shift that the state has to look at. It's a systemic shift that we have to look at, and a cultural shift, but also being able to understand, I think the biggest challenge that Southeast Asian, not just Hmong, but Southeast Asians and new immigrants from Asian American immigrants are facing is that America is polarizing a lot of the Asian Americans. I think there's this model minority that it's being pushed on us as far as all Asians being overrepresented in the fact that we know we have different Asian Americans that has been in this country for many different generations. And that reflects their economic impact there does reflect differently. So that is one of the challenges that we do see, is that as Asian Americans, we get lumped in into one group. And so some resources are limited to those that are of Southeast Asian or new immigrants not being able to access those resources. So it's really being able to understand the needs of individuals and communities versus lumping them all together. And we see that in the African-American communities too. Most recently, our Somali immigrants are here, and they then have different needs than our African-American Black community. So it's not just within the Asian-American, but it is a culture shift. It is the way of thinking and being able to identify that secondary impact from our initial bias, right?
Right. I think a lot of what we've been talking about so far is identifying the challenges or problems. Secretary Krim, has the council set a timeline as to when it will have recommendations ready for the governor?
Well, great question. Not just yet. As shared at the top of the program, we've only had our first meeting. The appointments are first set for 2 years, and this first year is developing a sustainable infrastructure in order to do the work, the framework to do the work. And so we're rolling up our sleeves and getting at it pretty quickly, but we have yet to have that next conversation because we are simply at the formulation stage, and that will be coming, the next steps will be coming out pretty soon.
All right. Don Krim, Mai Zhong, and Odawa White are among the 30 members of the Governor's Advisory Council on Equity and Inclusion, which was formed last month. And they spoke with my colleague Dean Kallenbach and me. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, the news and review, and a sound you're familiar with after this. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Hello, Brooks.
Hey, Robin.
And our own Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, Danielle Kading. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
So, Brooks, now that Emily Ford has completed her epic hike, we all should be ready to get out on the trails. There's some new developments with the Split Rock Campground and North Shore Tourism in general.
Well, we're going to see 46 new campsites up at Split Rock at the Lighthouse State Park up on the North Shore. Those campsites should be open this fall, it sounds like. And they're also, Lake County is also building out almost 24 miles of mountain bike trails that will be connected to this new development. North Shore tourism in general, looking up this season. We've talked with resort owners and businesses on the shore, and you know, all signs point to a much better spring than they had last year during the early months of the pandemic, of course, but also summer is booking up. And, you know, as Odyssey Resorts told me, back to normal for them means booked and business is booming. So they made it through the pandemic okay, and they're thinking that things are going to be a lot better and busier. So if you're looking at North Shore Adventures this summer, you better start planning now.
All right. What if we're looking back down in Duluth at Spirit Mountain?
Yeah, well, the snow we got this week should help a little bit, but the long-term outlook for Spirit Mountain is now under consideration by the Duluth City Council. So a task force and a consultant group were brought in to look at the sort of financial problems and the long-term picture for Spirit Mountain, the recreation area that's coming up on 50 years old. The report said about $23 million of improvements should be made to maximize sort of a return on investment in public dollars, boost the number of people who come, and ultimately boost the economic impact that Spirit Mountain brings. The report, for the first time in about 20 years, put a number on just how much economic impact the mountain brings to the community, about $18 for every $1 of tourism taxes spent. The city has poured in over $19 million in tourism taxes since the mountain was formed, and another $19 million in bonding dollars, some of which are still being paid off. So it's a big ask. And in the weeks ahead, Duluth City Council will be looking at essentially what they want to do with all this new information.
All right. Well, Danny, more of us will be getting outside for places like Spirit Mountain as more of us get vaccinated. What's this mean for businesses and one in particular?
Yeah, you know, a lot of small businesses across the state now are beginning to ramp up because they expect to see an uptick in customers. And Angie Kaminsky, who is the owner of the Superior Consignment Shop, Angie's Closet, said that she's already seen more customers in recent weeks and that they're definitely busier than they were like a month ago. And that's due in part because almost 20% of those who are eligible to receive the vaccine in Wisconsin have already received their first dose. And nearly 11% have gotten both doses, meaning that they're fully vaccinated. So they're considering different things as they're looking to navigate, you know, how much staffing or inventory they might need as things start to go back to normal a little bit, you know. Demand is a little bit uncertain right now, and, you know, customer preferences too might have changed over the last year, and just like activities and habits of when people go out to shop and how they're making those decisions. So small businesses like Angie's Closet are trying to navigate that as to when they should be open and how many people are around and that sort of thing.
Well, also pandemic related, and what we hope are the closing days of this pandemic, there's a tussle going on between Wisconsin's Republican legislature and the Democratic governor, not real news there, over the federal $1.9 trillion relief package.
Right. Yeah, it's no surprise that the Republicans and the Democratic governor are butting heads over many issues. And just the latest one is, as you said, the $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package. And under current law, the governor has pretty broad powers to spend federal money however he sees fit in the state. But GOP lawmakers have introduced a bill that would allow the state's budget committee, which is controlled by Republicans, to have power to block him and his administration's spending plans. Basically, they would want the administration to submit any plans that they have for spending that federal money to the committee, and then that committee would meet and decide whether or not to approve any of those proposals. But, you know, the Democratic governor, you know, Tony Evers, his office has kind of fired back that, well, Republicans during the first 6 months of the pandemic kind of sat on their hands and really waited a long time before passing response bills. And so they're saying that the governor can't afford to wait on Republicans and what they think is right to be able to infuse money into the recovery that's ongoing.
All right. Well, that cooperation or dispute continues. On a very serious note, all eyes have been on Minnesota and the Derek Chauvin trial getting underway this week. Wisconsin also has a high-profile murder trial coming up.
Yeah, it was actually a trial for Kyle Rittenhouse, who is the 18-year-old that's been charged with killing two people and injuring another after protests last summer in the wake of the Jacob Blake police shooting. His trial was set for the end of this month, but now that's been postponed until November. You know, attorneys from both sides of this case said that they just weren't ready to begin this month. And the DA in the case, Kenosha County Assistant District Attorney Thomas Binger, said that there are a number of things that still had to be taken care of, like some DNA testing that still had to come back. And basically, the Kenosha County Circuit Court Judge Bruce Schrader said that they're going to resume this case in November. And it's been a really controversial flashpoint with Rittenhouse. You know, he has been out on bail after conservative fundraisers posted his $2 million bond. And during the time that he's been out, he's been spotted in Wisconsin bars with members of the Proud Boys, which is a far-right group of self-described Western chauvinists. So people are really eager to see what happens with this case regarding Rittenhouse and the allegations against him that he killed Joseph Rosenbaum and Anthony Huber during those protests.
All right. And lastly, Brooks, you've kept us up to date on Miracle on Ice star Mark Pavlich, Now you have his final chapter.
Yes, unfortunately, Mark Pavlich, the 1980 Miracle on Ice hockey standout, Sevelis High School graduates, UMD hockey star, all of these great things. Pavlich was found dead at a treatment center last weekend. He was under commitment for the alleged attack against his neighbor up near Grand Marais in 2019. And things seem to be progressing in a positive manner, but so far we don't have any information on the cause of Pavlich's death. We do know the family wants his brain to be studied for CTE, which is often caused by repeated blows to the head while playing sports. It has been found in deceased football players, hockey players who have shown violent tendencies toward the end of their lives. The only way, unfortunately, to find out is through an autopsy. So there could be more to learn about Pavlich and his life beyond the inspiration he provided in his formative years and some of the unfortunate circumstances that surrounded him before his death.
Well, may he rest in peace and be well remembered for his many accomplishments. We've been speaking with Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for WPR News. Thank you, Danny.
Thank you, Robin.
And Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Thank you, Brooks.
Thanks so much, Robin.
You can read the stories by Brooks and the Star Tribune's entire Twin Ports Bureau at www.startribune.com/northreport, and be sure to subscribe to their local newsletter, because you really should. Next week on Simply Superior, you know this sound, right? The shipping season is about to resume, and our transportation expert, Dr. Richard Stewart, will tell us about all things rolling, sailing, or flying. Plus, if you can identify that horn, here it is again. You could join us on air to compete in the Simply Superior Sound Contest. Listen and check our website at wpr.org/programs/Simply Superior, and you'll see details. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We leave you with one more tribute to Emily Ford's Trek Along the Ice Age Trail, and you know this one too. Stay safe, everyone.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together? Happy trails to you.